KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think fundamentally, yes, I'm Gambian, yes, I'm British, but fundamentally, I'm a human being. And I think what Palestine does, when we say Palestine is a litmus test, we're saying that it is not that we privilege the Palestinian cause over every other cause, but rather Palestine holds a mirror up into the world and says, what kind of world do we want to live in?
Protests pressured Cornell University to re-enroll PhD student Mamadou Tal after he was suspended for joining pro-Palestine protests on campus last year. But now, the dual citizen of the United Kingdom and the Gambia finds himself targeted for deportation again after challenging the Trump administration's executive orders targeting universities and protesters who are foreign nationals. We'll speak with Mamadou Tal from an undisclosed location as ICE demands he turn himself in. Then an update on the case of Badr Khansouri, a Georgetown professor who had his visa revoked and was detained by federal agents without being accused of any crime. His wife is a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent.
The significance of Dr. Suri's arrest, I think, is threefold. Number one, an innocent man has been arrested. He's committed no crime. His life has been destroyed. Number two, this is directly connected to the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the attempt by the Trump administration to silence all anti-genocide voices. And number three, there's a brutal attack taking place against universities in this country, launched by the Trump administration, supported by right-wing Zionist forces.
We'll speak with a Georgetown professor who directs the center where Suri works. And as the Trump administration says Columbia University is on track to regain $400 million in federal funding after yielding to its demands, we'll get response from former Columbia Law School professor Catherine Franke.
Columbia not only caved to the demands in the ransom note, it did so in exchange for it seems to be nothing. And it did so by going beyond those demands and saying, oh, we'll do more.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gaza's health ministry says the official death toll has topped 50,000 as Israel continues to bombard and block Gaza. But it's widely believed the actual death toll is far higher. On Sunday, Israeli forces bombed a surgical unit at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, the largest functioning hospital in Gaza. The attack killed two people, including Ismail Bachoum, a member of Hamas's political bureau. Hamas said he was at the hospital for treatment for injuries suffered in an earlier Israeli strike. A 16-year-old boy was also killed in the hospital attack. The American trauma surgeon, Feroz Sidwa, was at Nasser Hospital at the time of the attack and said the teenager killed was his patient.
You know, I've certainly never had a patient injured in an explosion, brought to the hospital, taken care of, doing well, ready to go home, and then blown up in his hospital bed. That's a first. And that should be what we call in medicine a never event. That's not really supposed to happen. I can't emphasize enough, it just doesn't matter who is in the hospital. It's not legal to blow it up. It's not legal to kill people in here. It's not legal to attack people in here. It's not ethical. It's completely crazy.
To see our interviews with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, you can go to democracynow.org. In a separate strike, Israel blew up the Turkish Friendship Hospital, Gaza's only specialized cancer hospital. The hospital had been closed since November 2023 due to Israeli attacks. At one point, Israeli troops had turned the hospital into a military outpost. The Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned the bombing, saying it was, quote, part of Israel's policy aimed at rendering Gaza uninhabitable and forcibly displacing the Palestinian people, unquote. In other news on Gaza, Israel's security cabinet has approved forming what it calls a, quote, voluntary emigration bureau in Gaza, as Israel and the United States push for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. In Turkey, a court has formally arrested opposition leader, the Istanbul mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, days after he was detained on corruption charges. İmamoğlu is President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's biggest rival, seen by many as the best chance of ending Erdogan's long-standing autocratic rule. Following the news, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Istanbul, where they met with pepper spray and tear gas by police. Over 300 people have been arrested in demonstrations in recent days. Ahead of his arrest, Istanbul University revoked İmamoğlu's degree, a move which bars him from running for president. Nonetheless, his Republican People's Party, or CHP, said Ekrem İmamoğlu received overwhelming support during Sunday's election to select a primary candidate, including from millions of voters who are not party members. PHP leader Özgür Özel addressed Sunday's rally in Istanbul.
4 gün içeride tutup.
By keeping him in prison for 4 days, sending him to court while Turkey was going to the polls for him, and sending him to prison while Turkey was electing him, Erdogan defied not only him, but millions, and attempted to stage a coup.
Meanwhile, X, the social media platform owned by Elon Musk, has suspended a number of accounts belonging to opposition activists and academics in Turkey. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said Columbia University is on track to regain $400 million in federal funding after the Ivy League institution yielded to the Trump administration's demands Friday. Those include banning face masks on campus, hiring 36 new security officers with greater power to arrest and crack down on students, and appointing a senior vice provost to oversee the departments of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies and the Center for Palestine Studies. Students say they will continue to fight for Palestinian rights and for Columbia to divest from Israel. Free speech experts are sounding the alarm. This is Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
Unfortunately, it appears that Columbia has capitulated to the bullying of the Trump administration and ceded significant control over academic decisions, like a couple of departments, admissions, discipline, to the Trump administration in return for the Trump administration backing off from its threat to cut off $400 million in grants that have absolutely nothing to do with claims of anti-Semitism or failure to deal with it.
Columbia University students are returning to classes today after spring break. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. We'll speak with former Columbia Law School professor Catherine Franke. On Friday night, President Trump issued a memo directing the Attorney General Pam Bondi and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to punish law firms and lawyers who file what the administration views as frivolous or unreasonable lawsuits against the federal government. The memo is widely seen as a way to target immigration lawyers. Former Justice Department official Vinita Gupta said the memo, quote, attacks the very foundations of our legal system by threatening and intimidating litigants who aim to hold our government accountable to the law and the Constitution, she said. Meanwhile, a court battle continues over Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to transfer over 130 Venezuelan men from the United States to an El Salvadoran supermax prison after they were accused of being gang members. An appeals court will hear oral arguments today on the case. On Friday, U.S. District Judge James Boasberg called Trump's use of the law to be incredibly troublesome and problematic. The Trump administration's appealing Boasberg's decision to halt flights under the Alien Enemies Act. The Trump administration's announced plans to revoke temporary immigration protections for more than 530,000 people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela that were granted under a Biden-era humanitarian parole initiative known as CHNV. In other immigration news, the Washington Post is reporting the IRS is close to agreeing to a deal to give addresses and other personal information about suspected undocumented immigrants to the Department of Homeland Security. One former IRS official told the Post, quote, "It's a complete betrayal of 30 years of the government telling immigrants to file their taxes." In other related news, DHS has shut down three internal watchdog agencies that advocated for immigrants, including the Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. A federal judge Friday blocked Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, from deporting Jeanette Vizguerra, a well-known immigrant rights activist, mother of four, who was detained in Denver last Monday. U.S. Judge Nina Wang's order also prevents federal authorities from transferring Vizguerra out of Colorado and gave the government a deadline of today to demonstrate why Jeanette Vizguerra should not be released. The head of the U.S. Social Security Administration threatened Friday to shut down the agency, then backed down from the threat. Trump's head of Social Security, Leland Durek, made the initial threat after a federal judge blocked Elon Musk's Doge from accessing Social Security records, which the judge likened to a fishing expedition. Meanwhile, Trump's Commerce Secretary, the billionaire Howard Lutnick, has sparked outrage after suggesting only fraudsters would complain if Social Security checks didn't go out on time.
Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She thinks something got messed up. And she'll get it next month.
Yeah.
A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Elon Musk visited the Pentagon Friday for a high-level meeting with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and others. The New York Times had reported Musk was scheduled to receive a briefing on top-secret U.S. plans for a potential war with China. But the briefing was canceled after it was reported in the press. Musk threatened to go after whoever leaked what he called maliciously false information to the New York Times. Musk has close business ties with China, which is Tesla's second largest market. China is also the home of Tesla's largest factory. Elon Musk's Political Action Committee is offering voters in Wisconsin $100 to sign a petition opposing what he calls activist judges ahead of Wisconsin's Supreme Court election on April 1st. Two Musk-backed groups have spent over $20 million on the race to support Republican Brad Schimmel over Democrat Susan Crawford. The race will decide control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. U.S. and Russian officials are holding talks in Saudi Arabia today, a day after the U.S. held negotiations with Ukraine. The talks are focused in part on a proposed pause to attacks on energy facilities between Russia and Ukraine, as well as securing a possible maritime ceasefire in the Black Sea. On Sunday, a Russian drone attack killed seven people, including a five-year-old child, in Kyiv. Meanwhile, Ukrainian drone attacks killed two people in Russia. Sudan's military is retaking control over most of central Khartoum over the weekend after soldiers seized the presidential palace in the capital Friday. By Sunday, the Sudanese army also captured the central bank and the headquarters of the National Intelligence Service. Analysts say it could be a major turning point in the devastating civil war between Sudanese forces and the Rapid Support Forces, which is nearing the two-year mark and has created the world's largest humanitarian disaster. South African ambassador Ibrahim Rasool returned home to a hero's welcome Sunday after being expelled from Washington. Secretary of State Marco Rubio recently declared Rasool to be persona non grata in the latest move taken by the Trump administration against South Africa. Speaking in Cape Town Sunday, Rasool criticized the Trump administration for cutting off aid to South Africa.
We have tried to engage. We have been met with executive orders that cut our aid, cut PEPFAR, and now we sit with the idea that millions could be reinfected with HIV and AIDS. The research for the vaccine may not be one that could be completed. Those are the dangerous things that are happening and why we must mend our relationship or sit out the next 4 years.
South African Ambassador Rasool has also said South Africa will resist pressure from the U.S. and other nations to drop its genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. South Korea's Constitutional Court has dismissed the impeachment of Prime Minister Han Duck-soo Monday, reinstating him as acting president. Han took on the interim presidency after Yoon Suk-yeol was suspended over a short-lived declaration of martial law in December. Han's been accused of complicity in the failed martial law attempt and of refusing to appoint judges to the Constitutional Court. A ruling on Yoon's fate is expected soon. Mass protests have taken place over Seoul's streets amidst the deepening political turmoil. Canada's new Prime Minister Mark Carney called on Sunday for snap federal elections to be held April 28th.
We are facing the most significant crisis of our lifetimes because of President Trump's unjustified trade actions and his threats to our sovereignty. Our response must be to build a strong economy and a more secure Canada. President Trump claims that Canada isn't a real country. He wants to break us so America can own us. We will not let that happen.
Carney, a former central banker with little political experience, is hoping to consolidate his Liberal Party's power after the popularity of the opposition Conservative Party soared during his predecessor, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's final months in power. Greenland's prime minister has expressed outrage over what he called the Trump administration's highly aggressive plan to send Second Lady Usha Vance, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, and Energy Secretary Chris Wright to Greenland this week. Over the past 2 months, President Trump has repeatedly threatened to take control of Greenland, quote, one way or another. And on Friday, an estimated 34,000 people gathered in Denver, Colorado for a massive rally to hear Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York as part of their Fighting Oligarchy tour. It was the largest rally of either of their political careers.
We will not allow America to become an oligarchy. This nation was built by working people. And we're not going to let a handful of billionaires run the government.
Power and corruption is taking over this country like never before. And we are here, most importantly, because we know that a better world is possible.
AOC and Senator Sanders. Other speakers at the rally included Alvaro Bedoya, the Federal Trade Commissioner, who was fired by Trump last week and is suing for his reinstatement. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's coverage of the Trump administration's efforts to target free speech on college campuses with an update on a doctoral student at Cornell University who's joined in pro-Palestine protests on campus and now finds himself targeted for deportation again. Mamadou Tal is a PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University, a dual citizen of the United Kingdom and the Gambia. Last year, he was suspended twice for joining a demonstration calling on Cornell to divest from Israel. He faced deportation until massive protests pressured Cornell to allow him to re-enroll, thereby extending his visa. In February, Mamadou described the victory during an interview with Democracy Now!
With, as you said, public pressure, support, Cornell University back down, and I'm allowed to finish my degree. However, I am still banned from campus. I'm allowed in one building on campus to work. I have to fight to be able to get library access. And I think there's somewhat of a great irony that students who are protesting apartheid are now subject to forms of exclusion, bordering, and apartheid, with our movements restricted, and we're only allowed to go to designated places on campus.
Since Mamadou Tal spoke to Democracy Now! In February, he and two U.S. citizens filed a lawsuit to challenge two of the Trump administration's executive orders that, quote, combat anti-Semitism on college campuses and expel foreign nationals who it claims pose national security threats. Mamadou's lawyer says the government responded to the lawsuit by sending federal agents to monitor him. Then on Friday, the Department of Justice notified Mamadou's lawyer that the Trump administration is going to begin the process to carry out Mamadou's deportation. And ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ordered Mamadou to surrender at their office. Meanwhile, a hearing in the lawsuit Mamadou helped file that is challenging Trump's executive orders is set for Tuesday. That's tomorrow. For more, we're joined by Mamadou Tal from an undisclosed location. Mamadou, welcome back to Democracy Now! So you're reinstated at Cornell. You don't lose your visa. And yet now ICE says they're going to deport you. What happened?
Yeah, thank you so much. Good morning. And thank you so much for having me on. I mean, as you said, I think if you're going to take a step back, this is what happens when the universities don't stand by their students. And fundamentally, Cornell has placed a target on my back. Given the heavy-handed nature in which they repressed protests for pro-Palestine, they placed targets on their back, and this is the result of that now. So given the executive orders that, you know, were vague, broad, combating anti-Semitism, which made it incumbent on universities to collaborate and report on their students, given the high-profile nature of my case, I believe I was going to be a target eventually. And then we saw what happened with Mahmoud, and I thought, okay, what is my best bet at protection here? And that was going to be a lawsuit challenging the legality and constitutionality of Trump's executive orders. As we've seen right now, we have descended into a level of lawlessness that me wanting my day in court to be heard, which is a right, challenging the legality of the first legality of Trump's executive orders, I've been met with ICE agents or federal agents coming to my property. I've been told to surrender to ICE. My visa is revoked, all in what I believe to be a retaliation. All what I believe in is to prevent me from having my day in a federal court.
So what are you planning to do?
I would like to hear my, I want to hear, be able to have my day in court tomorrow. That is the plan. We have obviously prepared ourselves for all eventualities, but fundamentally in this country, the First Amendment does not just protect citizens, but it says persons. And our lawsuit is essentially challenging, first and foremost, my ability to speak, but also American citizens have the right to hear speech. What we're seeing now isn't just a crackdown on pro-Palestinian speech, even though that cannot be divorced from that, but we're seeing that any criticism of the state of Israel, any criticism of the United States government or Trump administration, you can be liable for deportation. So from the, if you ask me what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to challenge this, and we're seeking a national injunction, not just to protect folks myself, but also to protect anyone in the country who may be in a similar situation.
So Cornell University, because of protest, allowed you to continue as a student. Now you have expressed your concern that you're being followed by ICE and you're supposed to show up at a hearing tomorrow. What is Cornell doing? Are they doing anything to protect you? I have in mind Mahmoud Khalil right now, who was taken by ICE, is now in Jena, Louisiana, at an ICE jail. He had written personally to the president of Columbia, that's here in New York City. He had been, by the way, a negotiator for the pro-Palestine students with the university, and said he was asking for protection from the university. What about Cornell?
I have heard nothing from Cornell. Obviously, there have been great faculty who have been supportive in this truly difficult time. But I've heard from the administration, I have heard nothing. I can't speculate. I don't know their level of involvement in this. I wouldn't be surprised if they've been contacted, but I don't have no evidence for that at this moment. But I've heard nothing in terms of support, protection, other than some series of vague emails that go to the whole campus saying what to do if ICE comes and how they will not allow certain things to happen. But again, there's nothing been in by way of support of me.
Earlier this month, Cornell police detained at least 17 pro-Palestine protesters who disrupted a panel on the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The lecture was called Pathways to Peace and featured former Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni, who's been accused of war crimes in a suit filed by a UK pro-Palestinian group for her role in a major military offensive in Gaza in 2008.
100 children!
I have the right to be here.
Can you respond to the ongoing protests, Mamadou Tal, and why you've continued to protest yourself? You're from the Gambia, you're a Gambian and a British citizen. Why this issue, and you're majoring in, well, you're a graduate student in Africana Studies at Cornell, why is this issue so important to you?
I appreciate the question. I've said it before on your show, but I think for me, Palestine fundamentally holds up a mirror to the world and asks the question, what kind of world do we want to live in? And I think as tough as this moment is for me personally, it pales in comparison to what the Palestinians are going through. And I think this is, for me, a generational defining moment, a generational defining issue. And I think if the numbers of 18,000 children did not move people to action, then I don't think this is a world that we can be a part of or be proud of or want to even continue, because we have to ask ourselves, why is it there's a Palestine exception? What is it about the Palestinian issue that goes at the heart of this country? And what does it say? What questions does it force us to interrogate and engage with the world in this moment? So I think fundamentally, I'm still a human being. I have an alive heart and I cannot retire my moral conscience. So regardless of the sacrifice I have to make or the consequence, for me, that Palestine goes at the heart of the world today. And I think it's a generational defining issue.
Mamadou Tal, we want to thank you for being with us. We have 30 seconds. Any final words?
I just want to say to people, thank you so much for the support. I know things are scary. I know things are unfortunate in this moment, but I don't think the time is to keep quiet. I think the time is to double down, escalate, keep going, and keep raising the issue of Palestine.
Mamadou Tal, I want to thank you so much. PhD student in the Department of Africana Studies at Cornell University. Was almost deported last year, but because of massive protest against what was happening then, Cornell reinstated him. But now ICE is demanding he show up at a hearing with his lawyer tomorrow in Syracuse. We'll give you all the latest as we learn it. When we come back, we get an update on the case of Badr Khansouri, a Georgetown professor who had his visa revoked and was detained by federal agents without being accused of any crime. His wife, a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent. Stay with us.
Pull us up.
Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Trump administration escalates its attacks on pro-Palestine students and scholars, we turn to the case of Badr Khan Suri. Suri is originally from India, a Georgetown University professor and postdoctoral scholar on religion and peace processes in the Middle East and South Asia. Last Monday evening, he was ambushed by masked federal agents with the Homeland Security Department as he and his family returned to their home in Rosslyn, Virginia, after attending an iftar gathering for Ramadan. Suri was taken into custody without being charged or accused of any crime. He was told the federal government had revoked his visa. Over the next 72 hours, Suri was transferred to multiple immigration detention centers. He's currently jailed at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Alexandria, Louisiana, separated from his wife, a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent, and his three children. Suri's arrest came just days after federal agents apprehended Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil, who's being jailed at a different ICE detention center in Louisiana. Both are being detained under a rarely used provision of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952, which gives the U.S. Secretary of State authority to begin deportation proceedings against any non-citizen deemed a threat to U.S. foreign policy interests, even a green card holder like Mahmoud Khalil is. On Thursday, a federal judge in Virginia temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deporting Suri while he fights his case. DHS has accused Suri of, quote, spreading Hamas propaganda and claimed Suri has, quote, close connections to a known or suspected terrorist without providing any evidence. Suri's legal team says he's being targeted for his political views and free speech and pointed to an aggressive doxing and smearing campaign by pro-Israel groups targeting Suri's wife, Mafiz Salah. She's a graduate student at Georgetown and the daughter of Ahmed Yusuf, a former political advisor to Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated by Israel in Iran last year. Salah previously worked in a civilian role at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Gaza and met Suri after he joined a humanitarian convoy to the besieged territory in 2011. The couple then lived in New Delhi. Prior to Suri's arrest, pro-Israel groups published a series of articles and video clips targeting Salah and her family. One video clip was shared last month on the official X account of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., a photo of Salah and information about her, including her school and former employer, is also featured on an anonymously run website. Salah's father, Ahmed Yusuf, lives in Gaza and left his position in the Hamas government more than a decade ago, becoming a frequent writer and commentator on Hamas for publications like the New York Times. He recently told the Times Suri, his son-in-law, wasn't involved in any political activism on behalf of Hamas. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Nader Hashemi, a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at Georgetown University, the director of the center where Badr Khan Suri was hired as a postdoctoral fellow, Georgetown Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. Professor Hashemi, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain what's going on with Suri right now?
Well, it's a very similar case to Mahmoud Khalil. One of the differences is that Suri, in contrast to Khalil, was not a political activist. He was just a very serious young academic focusing on his teaching and his research. I think your description in the introduction provided a good background. He's currently in detention, we believe, in Louisiana. He has a court date in May. And of course, his family is completely devastated, and he himself is completely bewildered, because this is a young man from India, you know, who doesn't know anything about the, you know, the politics of Israel-Palestine, who Campus Watch is, what the Canary Mission is all about, why he was even targeted. So this came as a shock to him, his colleagues at Georgetown, and of course his family as well.
So explain exactly what happened. We've actually seen the video of Mahmoud Khalil, not to be confused with Suri. He's the former Columbia graduate student. He and his wife, Dr. Abdullah, were also coming home from iftar, and they were confronted by men in plain clothes who didn't have a warrant and unmarked car and told to go with them. He ended up in Gina, Louisiana. Explain what happened to Badr Khansouri.
So last Monday, exactly a week ago, in the afternoon, some of the staff that work at my center noticed some suspicious men hanging outside. They were clearly out of place. We now believe these were federal agents trying to arrest Badr Khansouri outside of his classroom. For some reason, they weren't able to apprehend him on campus. But roughly around 8 o'clock last Monday, as he was returning home after he broke his fast, agents arrested him. They were masked. There was an incident outside of his home. His young, one of his children witnessed the arrest, and then they told him your visa had been revoked and we're going to deport you. And then he was whisked off to a detention facility, I think originally in Alexandria, Virginia, and then he was sent to Louisiana, I believe, but I'm not 100% sure, in the same detention facility where Mahmoud Khalil was being held. And that's the story. And so then immediately there was a an attempt to sort of get him a legal representation to support the family, and then to get, you know, university officials to, you know, respond appropriately.
Mahfiz Salah, the wife of Badr Khansouri, wrote in a petition to the Eastern District Court of Virginia, quote, "Our children are in desperate need of their father and miss him dearly. They keep asking about him and when he'll come back. I cannot bring myself to tell them what has really happened to him, although my eldest child understands he's in some kind of trouble. I feel completely unsafe and can't stop looking at the door, terrified that someone else will come and take me and the children away as well," this American citizen said, who is the wife of Professor Suri. Can you respond to what she's saying and then talk about Georgetown's response?
Yeah, so the family here has been devastated. They've been shocked. The children are traumatized. I do believe the target here was not my colleague Badr Khansouri, but it was his wife, who's a Palestinian from Gaza. They couldn't arrest her because she's a U.S. citizen, so they went after a much easier target, her husband, who, of course, you know, has committed no crime. He was just doing his work. He's not a political activist. And I think that that's an important part of the story. The other important part of the story here is that the origins of this begins on the right-wing social media sphere, where these, you know, extreme pro-Israel fanatics find a target and they start tweeting about it, tagging the Israeli embassy, tagging Marco Rubio. And then within a few days, Rubio sends in the shock troops. That's the background. So the family is traumatized, the children as well. The university at Georgetown, I think, deserves some credit here because they've been privately very supportive but publicly cautious. Everyone is watching what's happening at Columbia University. No one wants to see their university targeted in the same way that Columbia has been targeted. I would give you know, my employer high marks for trying to navigate this situation and do the right thing. And now there's a lot of student and faculty mobilization on campus trying to provide support, trying to protest what's happening, but also linking this to, you know, the ongoing genocide in Gaza. I think this is a, you know, important part of the story that we have to get out, that there's an attempt here to silence any and all voices, you know, on campus that are critical of this genocide in Gaza. And of course, against the backdrop of this is this, you know, very deep-rooted anti-Palestinian bigotry that exists at the highest level of the American government, in particular in the Trump administration. Your listeners might recall that during the presidential campaign, on several occasions, Donald Trump used the word Palestinian as a slur to attack his political opponents. And so it's against that backdrop that the U.S. can support an ongoing genocide in Gaza, which is intensified, you know, in the last week. And, you know, the Democratic Party as well is guilty. And there's been very little pushback. So this, you know, targeting of people who are just married to a Palestinian, that's really the crime here that I think my colleague is being charged with, is that he hasn't done anything wrong, but he's married to a Palestinian, and that, you know, on rare occasions he's tweeted and expressed support for Palestinian suffering and the, you know, national rights of the Palestinians. So he gets picked up because he's an easy target, because he's on a visa. And so he can easily be, you know, deported from this country. I think those are the important elements of this story that, you know, I think people need to understand.
We're about to talk about Columbia University and the agreement it's made with the Trump administration. But before we go, I wanted to read two quotes, one from Joel Hellman, who is Georgetown Dean of the School of Foreign Service, who released a statement on the detention of Badr Hansouri that reads in part, quote, "During his time on campus, I am not aware Dr. Suri is engaged in any illegal activity, nor has he posed a threat to the security of our campus. As an individual, I'm deeply concerned for the welfare of a member of our community and his family. As dean, I'm deeply troubled by the chilling effects such events could have on freedom of expression on this campus, which is, of course, at the very core of our mission. We expect the legal system will adjudicate this case fairly," he said. This comes as the dean of Georgetown's law school rejected a warning from the acting federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C., who said his office won't consider Georgetown students for jobs, internships, or fellowships until the law school ends diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Acting U.S. Attorney Ed Martin made the threat in an email on March 3rd, writing it's unacceptable that Georgetown Law, quote, continues to promote and teach DEI, unquote. Dean William Traynor wrote in response, quote, "Given the First Amendment's protection of a university's freedom to undermine its own curriculum and how to deliver it, the constitutional violation behind this threat is clear, as is the attack on the university's mission as a Jesuit and Catholic institution," unquote. If you can finally, in this last 30 seconds, respond.
Yeah, I'm glad you read those quotes. I think, you know, the Georgetown administration are trying to do the right thing. What's clearly happening here is we have a, you know, an alliance between these MAGA Republicans and these extreme Israel supporters in this country who are really trying to, you know, undermine the basic legal and political architecture of the United States and freedoms that we just took for granted. I never thought in a million years that, you know, what happened at Cornell, what happened at Columbia, and what's happening at Georgetown could happen in the United States. So this is a major assault on, you know, the American Constitution and on the basic idea of an independent university. That's what's at stake here. And so everyone needs to mobilize. Everyone who cares about those values needs to mobilize and push back against this authoritarian juggernaut that's coming to strangle all of us.
Nader Hashemi, professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at Georgetown University, director of the center where Badr Hansouri was hired as postdoctoral fellow, Georgetown Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. Next up, the Trump administration says Columbia University is on track to regain $400 million in federal funding after the university yielded to the Trump administration's demands. We'll get response from former Columbia Law School professor Catherine Franke. Stay with us. Liberation Frequency by Refused. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Education Secretary Linda McMahon says Columbia University is on track to regain $400 million in federal funding after the Ivy League school yielded to the Trump administration's demands Friday. Those include banning face masks on campus, hiring 36 new security officers with greater power to arrest and crack down on students, and appointing a senior vice provost to oversee the departments of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies, and the Center for Palestine Studies. Students say they'll continue to fight for Palestinian rights and for Columbia to divest from Israel. Free speech experts are sounding the alarm. For more, we are joined by Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School. She was forced to resign after two members of the Columbia community claimed she created a hostile environment for Israelis at Columbia after Frankie appeared on our show, Democracy Now!, in January 2024 to discuss a chemical attack on pro-Palestinian student activists. Frankie serves on the board of Palestine Legal. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! Professor Frankie, first, if you can talk about what has happened at Columbia University. Talk about this agreement that they have made. And also, if you want to comment on your own status at Columbia University.
Well, it's lovely to see you, Amy. Thank you for inviting me back. I think it would be inaccurate to describe what Columbia and the federal government have entered into as an agreement. The federal government seized funds that they were legally obliged to deliver to Columbia researchers and then issued a ransom note saying, we will consider negotiations further with you if you do the following things. Columbia considered it and did more than what the ransom note demanded, for which it got nothing in return. Normally, when someone is kidnapped or there's some kind of ransom taken, you agree to the things in the ransom note, and then you get your stuff back. You get your money back. You get your person back. In this case, Columbia merely supplicated itself before the federal government, and then we hear Linda McMahon say, well, this is on the road, on track to what we'd like to see. So we have no idea what comes next. But groveling before a bully, we all know, just encourages the bully.
I want to go through the points that Columbia University has either acquiesced to or just says that they will institute. And let's remember, today is the day students return after spring break. Is this already in force? I'd like you to address the issue of this new, unusual security force. It's not exactly Columbia security. It's not the New York Police Department, but it has the power to arrest students on campus. Also, the issue of masks on campus and the new vice president, this kind of provost in charge of several academic departments.
Well, they only announced these changes last Friday, and today's Monday. It's the first day of school after spring break, so we'll see. But remember, Amy, the university's been on lockdown for months and months. I still have to go through two checkpoints in order to get to my office at the law school. We have public safety officers inside the campus everywhere and NYPD outside the campus. And it seems the university was more than willing to call in the NYPD at both at Columbia and at Barnard to arrest students. So in some ways, this isn't a huge change for daily life for the students. They've been living in a kind of security state while they're trying to learn and do the things that students do for quite some time. But the rest of these new initiatives will take some time to roll out. But those people who are in the departments, whether they're students, faculty, staff, that are now being monitored by a newly created senior vice provost are really worried. My syllabus is going to be looked at. Is someone going to be sitting in my classes? Are they going to be reviewing our graduate students and who we admit into our programs? Columbia has gone from being really a bastion of free speech. It's why I went there as an undergrad in the late 70s and 80s. And the president we had until quite recently, Lee Bollinger, was one of the most stellar stars in defense of academic freedom and free speech, to the situation where now Columbia University has become part of the apparatus of chilling speech, critical of the state of Israel and critical of the United States. It's not just managing a difficult situation, it is actually implementing that censorship in the name of the university's mission. And I think that's what's shocking. The faculty, the students, the members, and the alums, I'm hearing from so many alums, they want to burn their degrees. They're so embarrassed by how Columbia has been behaving itself.
In a letter, Columbia's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, wrote, quote, Amidst a historically charged and divisive political atmosphere, academic institutions of all places must be able to operate with wisdom and deliberation, even as our various constituencies are moved to articulate different positions. Responsible stewardship means we must consider every appropriate action, work with our partners across the nation, and we're doing so. Legitimate questions about our practices and progress can be asked, and we'll answer them. But we will never compromise our values of pedagogical independence, our commitment to academic freedom, or our obligation to follow the law. Your response, Professor Franke?
Well, I mean, those are lovely words, but if you look at what the university's doing and the statement that they issued of these new policies last Friday, they're doing the absolute opposite of what President Armstrong has professed. So they're speaking out of two sides of their mouth and trying to make the best of what is in a very difficult situation. I would, of course, admit that. But if you look at what Bill Traynor, the dean at the Law School at Georgetown that you were just reporting on earlier, has said, and what other university officials at other schools have said, there's a path for universities to stand up to this. And the time to negotiate is over. These are test balloons, what they've done with Mahmoud Khalil, what they've done with other students by threatening to deport them or deport them, what they've done to Paul Weiss, Perkins Coie, these law firms, and what they're doing to Columbia, these are test balloons to see what kind of resistance and pushback they're going to get. So far, very little. And I think, you know, Amy, we need to buckle our seatbelts. Things are about to get a lot worse in April and in May, because this administration knows that it can get away with an awful lot of conduct and chilling speech and authoritarian governance with very little resistance from institutional actors like universities as powerful, we thought, as Columbia, or law firms that we thought were as powerful as Paul Weiss. So these actions are designed to kind of test the water. How far can we go? And they now know they can go all the way.
I want to ask you about targeting law firms like Paul Weiss, but I want to just ask you about this amazing piece in the New York Times. Decades ago, Columbia refused to pay Trump $400 million. And it says a quarter century ago, the university was looking to expand. It considered and rejected property owned by Donald Trump. He did not forget it. When he didn't get his way, he stormed out of a meeting with university trustees and later publicly castigated the university president as a dummy and a total moron. That drama dates back 25 years. You can't help but notice that there he stood to gain $400 million, and he was going to sanction the university, take away $400 million in federal funding unless they complied. Your quick response to that, Professor Franke?
Well, I mean, who knows if that number, $400 million today, of which they've withheld from Columbia, and indeed, I think that they've actually held more, it just hasn't been in the media. It certainly corresponds to that earlier number, and we well know that President Trump is known for holding a grudge and holding it for many, many years. So I presume it's possible that this number he came up with relative to Columbia relates in some way to that earlier real estate deal. But to be honest, I find that to be a bit of a distraction. I think we need to look forward and to think about how we can salvage our universities at this moment. At noon today, the faculty is going to be holding a vigil outside the gates of Columbia University for the university that has now died. And we're trying to figure out, where do we go from here? So I think looking backward is actually less productive than thinking about where we go in this moment, where I personally feel like we have to work with our university. We need each other rather than seeing it as only our enemy.
Let me ask you about Mahmoud Khalil. You had helped to advise him, the former Columbia graduate student who sought out the Columbia president's help when he thought he was being followed and he felt threatened, and is now has been picked up apparently by the Department of Homeland Security, is in immigration jail in Louisiana. What should the university do? Catherine Franke.
Well, the university should have stood up for him and corrected what I know to be horrible falsehoods said about Mahmoud. I've worked with him for over a year. He was chosen by the leadership of Columbia University to be the mediator, the voice they wanted to speak to when the encampment started last spring. He's a mature, reasonable, careful, responsible person, and they saw in Mahmoud someone who could play that role of mediator between this, both sides. The students trusted him, the university trusted him. And then when people in our community at Columbia set him up, I mean, it's important to recognize that the finger was pointed at him by members of the Columbia University community calling for the federal government to arrest him. And the university did not stand up for him. They let it happen. He had written to Katrina Armstrong asking for help. And other students are in the same position right now, I will note. He will not be the only or last one who faces this kind of situation. And the university did nothing. They left him as a sitting duck, and then they didn't speak out in defense of the role that he has played at Columbia with their invitation and consent. So I see Columbia as playing a role of putting a target on his back, in essence.
So you're talking about other students. This comes as Indian national Ranjani Srinivasan left the U.S. earlier this month after enrollment and student visa was unlawfully revoked before she was expected to graduate this year with a doctoral degree from Columbia's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning and Preservation. Her lawyer said she was arrested the night students took over what's now known as Hinds Hole, though she did not actually participate in that protest. On Saturday, she released an open letter that read in part, with the rapidly escalating situation, the criminalization of free speech, and imminent travel bans, what has happened to me can happen to you. Therefore, we must exert maximum pressure on Columbia and other universities to protect international students from these arbitrary state actions. And we must fight for complete amnesty and reinstatement for those whom Columbia has sacrificed in the hope of reversing funding cuts. Now is the time to come together and demand universities do the right thing, Srinivasan wrote. Very quickly, your comment on this, Professor Franke.
Well, I think her case is a horrendous object lesson. She was not part of the protest. She was not arrested connected to the protest, and her visa was revoked nevertheless. I think her leaving and going to Canada was a reasonable action on her part because she knew what would come next, even though there was absolutely no reason to revoke her visa or to detain her. And I would say that the other students who were involved in other protests, they too were engaging in what we should understand to be protected First Amendment political speech. But she wasn't even involved in those actions. So that's where it's radiating out, is that they're identifying students who are vulnerable, and in most cases, black and brown, students of color, who are vulnerable in the sense that they have visas that could be revoked based on completely specious charges. And I feel horrible for her, as I do for Mahmoud, and the other students who are cowering in their dorm rooms right now, afraid to leave the building because there are sketchy guys out front with big vans with tinted windows waiting for them. I can't overemphasize how frightening it is for our students to be attending a university, hoping to get an education when the university is actually collaborating in their very peril.
In this last 30 seconds we have, Professor Catherine Franke, how would you characterize this moment in time, this moment in U.S. history?
Well, I think what we're seeing, and this is what's happening at Columbia and these other schools, it's just a small piece, is the collapse of a constitutional order that the Trump administration has very deftly exploited. There are anti-democratic elements in our constitutional system that this administration has very adeptly exploited and has put out these test balloons, as I've said, with universities and law firms. And what they're about to do next, I think we all have to be very worried about.
And we're going to continue.
As we saw the Berlin Wall.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hold. Joshua was a prodigy. Since he was a kid of three, he could play a rhapsody as good as they come. But as strange as it may be, Joshua hated melody. He had a yen for timpani. He longed to play a drum. When his mama made him practice on his fiddle every day, he'd stop right in the middle and he'd say, Mama, I wanna make rhythm.